This is the April 2022 edition of Review, the Journal of Blind Veterans UK. If you listen to Review using a USB stick, can I ask you please not to forget to return it, along with its plastic pouch that it comes in, so that we can reuse it. Thank you very much. A new reality. Welcome to your April issue of Review. It's frightening to think how the world has changed since last month's edition. Ironically, in that one, I wrote about International Happiness Day and the UN Global Happiness Index, which has been topped by Finland for years. Just a couple of short weeks later, and the situation in Ukraine is causing untold misery across Europe and beyond, and no doubt making the Finns feel very uneasy, being that they also border Russia. The Ukrainians are being forced to face a whole new reality as their lives are thrown into unimaginable danger and chaos. The towering spirit of this nation has been admirable, as has the outpouring of support for them, but still their situation is desperate. Our leadership team is therefore thinking very carefully about how we as a charity can use our expertise to help, and we will be telling you more about that later in this issue. We also share uplifting stories in this issue, despite the situation, to give you some much needed hope. One highlight is a report from our member design group on their first recce of our new centre in Rustington. Another is a refreshingly honest interview with member Peter about how he came to terms with a new reality of his own, sight loss in his early 50s. Another still is a piece by 90-year-old Globetrotter John, who shares fascinating snippets from a life lived in different countries. But I'm afraid the bad news keeps on coming, and it's with deep regret that I end with the sad news that our Vice President and former trustee, Paul Palmer, passed away on the 12th of March. Paul was a popular member whose full life embodied the Blind Veterans UK indomitable spirit of victory over blindness. As this news has come in as we go to press, we will include a fitting tribute to Paul in the next issue of Review. Please take good care. Liz Miller, Editor. A united vision. Your message from your chairman, Barry Koop. As I write, the situation in Ukraine is worsening by the day, and I am deeply concerned and appalled by what's happening there, as I'm sure you are too. The remarkable courage of the Ukrainians is a shining example to us all, and we can only hope and pray for their safety and a swift end to the atrocities. I believe it's important to focus on positives at this time, so we would like to share news from an important meeting I had recently with a research organisation we co-founded and continue to sponsor, Action Against Age-Related Macular Degeneration, known as AAAMD. We met to discuss a groundbreaking project they are embarking on to improve the chances for people with age-related macular degeneration. A staggering 196 million people around the world suffer from this terrible condition, including many of our members. But although it's the most common cause of sight loss in the developed world, there isn't any treatment for the vast majority, and no chance of stopping it early. The underlying cause is still unknown. Funnily enough, just a couple of days before our meeting, I'd been to the opticians because I was feeling pressure on one of my eyes. My mother had macular degeneration in later life. She lived to 100. And I know there's a hereditary component. I turned up for my appointment and they went the whole nine yards, giving me a scan and all the tests, and then comparing the results to those of 2 years ago. In the end, they told me there's nothing wrong, and I left feeling relieved in the knowledge that everything's fine. However, in my meeting with AAAMD, I heard that it's currently impossible to detect macular degeneration early on. Of course, my question was, even though I've just been told that my macula looks fine, are you telling me there may be problems there that they simply can't detect? I was surprised to hear that this is indeed the case. So there's an urgent need for this research, the aim of which is to find a way to diagnose the onset of macular degeneration earlier and ultimately find treatment that can deal with it. This is a hugely exciting project for us to be involved in. While our goal at Blind Veterans UK is to support as many visually impaired veterans as possible, the dream for this charity has to be that one day we'll simply not be needed at all. I really do hope that day comes. Over the past few weeks, as I've been getting to grips with my new role and meeting staff teams, I've been struck by just how positive and unified everyone is. Nowhere is this more apparent than on the new Rustington Centre build, which I'm heavily involved in due to my architecture background. So far, I'm very pleased with the way it's all going. I feel confident it will be a really nice space and will offer you so much, even more than our Brighton Centre does. I'm very much looking forward to hearing the views and feedback from more and more of you as the design and build continues to progress. As far as I'm concerned, everyone in this wonderful organisation, whatever their skill set and experience, is an important part of the team. We have only one aim, and that's to support you, our members, in the best way we can.
Our support for Ukraine. Our CEO, Nick Kaplan, outlines our organisational response to the conflict as the time of going to press. With the extremely tragic situation in Ukraine developing, some of you have been asking how we are responding and showing our support for the Ukraine. I write to you today to let you know about the actions we are taking regarding your questions as follows. How is Blind Veterans UK showing support for Ukraine? Both our centres are showing signs of support and solidarity with Ukraine through the use of flags and colours lit up on our buildings. We are also in support of and encouraging staff, volunteers and members who are able to give to the Disaster Emergency Committee and local donation centres. And there is an email address for that Disaster Emergency Committee, which is dec.org.uk, all lowercase. In the event of UK military intervention, will we be ready to take in new members? At the time of writing, the UK government has been clear that they do not intend to send British forces to Ukraine. However, we continue to look at our preparedness and are committed to providing support to future UK combat blind members. Will we be supporting the combat blind in Ukraine? One of our strategic objectives is to be a national force for good, and we are starting to explore what we can do with other organisations to support those blinded in defence of Ukraine. This work is in its very early stages, and we are drawing on a range of expertise from across the charity and beyond. What can I do to help? We absolutely encourage anyone who can to donate to the Disaster Emergency Committee and similar humanitarian charities. Thank you for all that you are doing to support each other as this terrible situation continues to unfold.
Neville and Ray do their bit for Ukraine. During a recent stay at our Llandudno Centre, some of our members, including Neville Bowen and Ray Gawler, decided to knit woolly hats in the Ukrainian flag colours of yellow and blue to show their solidarity with the people of Ukraine. These hats and more to come have been added to a number of other items collected at the centre, for donation to a local collection centre. They will be transported directly to Ukrainians in need. Register your place on Military Week, 12th of June. Please join us in Llandudno in June for a special Military Week to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Falklands War. This is a great opportunity for veterans to enjoy a week full of military-themed activities and swap experiences and memories. You'll get to listen to guest speakers, take part in a trip to the Imperial War Museum North, and participate in visits to local units where you'll meet serving personnel and explore modern military hardware. We've also been invited by the British Royal Legion to attend a remembrance parade during the week at our local cenotaph on the seafront. This will be followed by a regimental-style military dinner where we will dress in our best for the evening. To find out more and register your place, please contact the Llandudno bookings team on 01492 868 700. Simon releases survival guide to sight loss. Member Simon Mahoney has published a new book to support others adapting to life with sight loss. The book, Winging It Blind, is Simon's third and is packed with advice, information and guidance, not just for those with sight loss, but for family members and professionals too. Simon served in the Royal Marines in the 60s and lost his sight later in life due to glaucoma. He now says he feels incredibly grateful to have become a member of Blind Veterans UK. His book was written using a specially adapted PC and word processing software we have supplied. Simon says, Blind Veterans UK has always been there alongside me to navigate the challenges that arise when adapting to life with sight loss. I can't thank this charity enough for the support I've received over the years. By giving me training on the computer, I'm now able to share my experience with others. All the support I've been given has been fantastic, from white cane training, which means I'm able to get out and about in my local area, to the general warmth and understanding of everyone involved. I thank God every day that I'm part of this wonderful charity. And Winging It Blind is available to buy on Amazon and at wingingitblind, that's all one word, .com.
A Way Out of the Darkness. Member Peter O'Malley describes his journey of coming to terms with sudden sight loss. I lost my sight literally overnight when I was in my early 50s. It was a huge shock, completely overwhelming. I'd taken a break from my minicab business to care for my wife while she was ill. Soon after she died, I woke up one morning with very little vision. My first thought was that it was just sleep in my eye, but when it didn't shift, I assumed it was down to all the stress I'd been under. I went to the doctor, and he told me to get down to the hospital immediately. The consultant knew what it was straight away, a very rare condition called AON, which is acute optic neuritis. It left me with just 5% vision in one eye. I remember a staff member from Northampton Association for the Blind, NAB, coming round to talk to me and very gently handing me a white stick. I just thought, what? I'm not blind. I just couldn't believe it. At Blind Veterans UK, the process of being able to live well with blindness is summed up as the three A's: accept, adapt, and achieve. This means the first step is to accept you're blind. Once you've accepted it, you can find ways to adapt and go on to achieve the things you want in life. So it's a massive thing to accept it. Just to get my head around the fact that I couldn't drive anymore was hard enough. I lost my business, and of course, my role as a dad changed because I'd been taxi driver to my kids too, taking them to school and parties and wherever. I was encouraged to attend the National College for the Blind in Hereford for 6 months. Although I was struggling with a deep sadness about losing my sight, I found that mixing with other blind people helped me to deal with the negative emotions and start thinking about what I could do with the rest of my life. I went on to complete a degree in English literature at Warwick University, which I really enjoyed. I've no periphery vision in my working eye, so it's like looking through a smarty tube. Over the years, I've learnt to move around slowly and scan the immediate area to see what's around me. You need to experiment to find out what works for you. You're forced to be humble because you need to ask for help. You can't do it on your own. Being blind can be depressing because it's very isolating. It's as if you're on a ship in a storm getting bashed around. You're looking for a safe haven, for stability. I found that stability with Blind Veterans UK and with NAB. These organisations really became my anchor. I remember when I first lost my sight, I attended a weekly local computer group for blind people organised by NAB. It saved me. When you hang out with others who are visually impaired, you naturally want to help each other. Since I joined Blind Veterans UK just over 10 years ago, I've received massive support from the charity, from IT training to sports activities and arts and crafts opportunities. I even did a triathlon at one point, which was great fun. And I've made good friendships here too. There's a lot of good-hearted banter, which I love. Nowadays, I work part-time for the charity, checking information for new members. I'm married again, and we have 14 grandchildren between us. I'm also an active member of the church. After I left the army at 24, I felt lost and went off the rails. This forced me to start reading books on philosophy and religion. To this day, my faith helped to give me a sense of purpose. What would I say to members who are feeling low? Talk about it. Talk to someone you can trust and mix with others. You're not on your own. The Blind Veterans UK promises that you've got others on this journey with you. Throughout the pandemic, I've participated in the online fitness classes for working age members twice a week. I also joined the remote mosaic art and photography classes. When you join in with activities like these, you develop friendships. It can really help. It's massive, actually. It really does make all the difference. Following on from the last article, here's Peter's top tip for well-being. I've been logging in for the online exercise classes for working age members throughout the pandemic. I use my laptop and do the exercises in my back garden, although I realise that most sensible people exercise inside their homes. A typical exercise session might include four sets of different exercises, such as squats, cross-body crunches, frog jumps and press-ups. The staff at Brighton who run the sessions have been truly excellent. I think if you keep up your general fitness, then it helps with everything else. Regular exercise can help prevent heart problems like heart trouble, health problems, diabetes and even cancer. It's also good for your mental health, and the camaraderie and friendship that come from exercising together is really fun. The classes are still going strong if you'd like to join in. Just ask your community support worker for more information.
The first recce at Rustington. As work gets underway on the new centre, our member design group report back on their visit. At the end of February, our newly formed Rustington Centre member design group made their very first visit to the site to consult on the planning and build. The group has been tasked with letting us know about any specific needs they think should be considered to make the centre the best it can possibly be. They were given a tour of the main building, the outbuildings, and also the seafront that sits just behind. One member of the group, Alan Walker, is a regular user of the Brighton Centre in normal times and lives locally. He's also the working age member representative for Sussex. Alan said, "As someone who was against the move to the new centre, my view has changed. It's in a prime location and the outbuildings are an added bonus, although the focus will be on getting the main building ready first. I think the new centre is in a good place, right next to the beach. The building itself is a lot more compact and all on one level, which is also a bonus." One issue Alan did raise was how members would travel to and from the centre. "This is something that will need to be addressed before we move in, ideally through working with the local community." Another member of the group, Sue Isles, is a guide dog owner and is therefore particularly concerned with ensuring the centre is set up for assistance dogs. She came away from the visit saying, "The moment that struck me most was when a dog walker on the beach spotted us and came over to say how great he and the local community think it is that we're moving to Rustington. I think the fact that we are taking over the building from the RAF Benevolent Fund is great for us, and clearly the local community agree. We spoke about how we can become part of the local community, and that can only be a good thing." Member Terry Bullingham, who lives in Sussex, was asked to join the group as he has an engineering background. He said, "There's a lot more space than I thought there was going to be, and the good thing about the space is that it's very adaptable. It's going to be a big job, but there's huge potential. I'll be trying to input on practical elements that will make it easier for members using the centre, like symmetry, which is very important for those of us with a vision impairment. I'll also chip in on other areas in the broader design. For example, I've suggested we look into ground source heat pumps that could heat the whole building." Another member, Billy Baxter, was involved in making sure our Llandudno Centre was fit for purpose when we bought it over 10 years ago. Billy joined the group so he can relay lessons learnt from that experience, and he came away from the visit feeling positive. He said, "It was with some trepidation that I made my first visit to our new centre, but I was pleased to see it's on the doorstep of Rustington, a thriving and busy little town with amazing amenities, all within walking distance. The centre is similar in size to the frontage of our Llandudno Centre, with the reception and entrance in the middle and automatic sliding doors. Like Llandudno, there are two wings, left being the east wing with wide corridors and the dining room and lounge being one room, much the same as Hogwarts in Llandudno. I was surprised at the size and depth of this area, which leads to a nice size conservatory with doors leading to the rear grounds and outside areas. The grounds are compact with outbuildings all in good condition and grassed areas and pathways." He added, "The new site has a lovely feeling and its own unique character. My overall impression is that it will service blind veterans well and will be well received in the local community. I look forward to visiting again once the building works and the main building takes shape. I think we have something very special in the Rustington Centre. We will continue to update you on how the design and build of our new centre is progressing. For further information and to share your views, please speak to your community support worker about joining your local member engagement panel."
You'll never walk alone. Community support worker Jenny Gaywood reports on Community 7's brilliant virtual step challenge. Last year, four groups of members from across West Somerset, Devon and Cornwall joined virtual walking challenges during the lockdown period. Each team chose a route and members were issued with a talking pedometer to log their steps every day. They then joined a weekly online social chat group with their community support worker to talk about how many steps they had taken during the week. This was converted into miles and put onto a map to show the team's progress along the route. Two groups chose to virtually walk the entire length of the historic Southwest Coastal Path, which is 630 miles and runs from Minehead in Somerset along the coasts of Devon and Cornwall to Poole Harbour in Dorset. Overall, the groups walked a whopping combined total of 1,260 miles. During the group chats, members enjoyed interesting conversations about the place they had virtually reached every week, and great friendships were formed. Thanks to a bit of healthy competition between those taking part, they managed to clock over 3.5 million steps overall over a 15-week period. They reported lots of fantastic benefits from taking part in the challenge, from increased fitness and mobility to feeling more active and engaged. One group even met up afterwards and received medals in celebration of their achievement. This is what some of our members said. Bob T said, "I found the step challenge a huge incentive to walk much further than I would normally, particularly with the pedometer and the weekly group call to report in my steps. It helped me lose weight and get out and interact with others on my route to Brixham, Breakwater and back." Ray C said, "I find life can be a bit boring when you can't see, particularly during the lockdown. The challenge made life more interesting. It broke the monotony and gave me something to aim for." Ray D said, "This challenge has shown that we can still achieve things despite our sight loss. It got us out and gave us a way to compete against ourselves to try and increase our steps. It's a great way to get out and about." Don G said, "It was an excellent idea. It encouraged us to walk more." And Brian H said, "It's really encouraged me to walk more. Some members actually doubled their weekly steps from the first week to the last." Onwards and upwards. After a short break, three groups took on more virtual step challenges. Group 1 virtually walked from Cornwall to Harcourt Street via the Brighton Centre, criss-crossing the country to each member's house along the way. They also headed past Brown Willey, the highest tor in Cornwall, and traversed Dartmoor with the Baskerville Hounds on their heels. The walking was challenging, but they marched on to the south coast and then up to London. Group 2 virtually walked from John O'Groats to a member's home in Brixham, which was 980 miles in total. After battling the Scottish terrain, they were in Manchester for Christmas, home of the berry black pudding. They've now virtually arrived in Brixham and plan to meet up again to celebrate their achievement. Meanwhile, Group 3 virtually walked 175 miles from Penzance, Cornwall's most westerly major town, to Land's End, which is the most westerly point of mainland Cornwall and England. Land's End was the starting point of the 2012 Summer Olympics torch relay, and their route went via the Eden Project, described as the eighth wonder of the world. These challenges have been incredibly friendly and fun, and Group 1 was able to meet up in person for the first time during their walk. Now, as we head into spring, they are about to embark on their next steps challenge. We wish them luck. And feeling inspired, why not take on a steps challenge of your own or speak to your community support worker about activities to get you moving? Dust off the karaoke machine. Our people officer, Emily Edwards, shares the many health benefits of singing. It's official. Belting out a tune is good for you, no matter what your neighbours say. Studies suggest that singing not only enhances your mood, but can actually benefit your immune system and your blood pressure and also reduce feelings of chronic pain. In fact, a good warble can be so good for your health that some GPs in England have even started prescribing it for certain medical conditions. TV health expert Dr. Michael Mosley explores the benefits of singing in his podcast, asking how a good croon can help your body and mind. Here are the highlights. Up where we belong. One of the most notable impacts of singing is the immediate boost in your mood. In his podcast, Mosley reveals how singing is thought to release happy hormones, such as dopamine and endorphins, which give us a natural high. But that's not all. He also says that research suggests singing may have similar effects on the body to cannabis. Apparently, we have chemical compounds in our bodies called endocannabinoids, which are similar to the active component of the cannabis plant. One study involving a group of women over 50 found that singing in a choir increased levels of endocannabinoids in their blood by a whopping 42%. Many people living with chronic pain report that regular singing lessens their need for painkillers to control their pain. It's also been found to increase levels of oxytocin, a social bonding hormone, which may help explain why singing is such a good icebreaker. Staying alive. However, one of the most surprising findings from recent research is that singing in a group for as little as 1 hour may boost your immune system. One study compared the impact of singing with the effects of listening to music and found that those who sang produced higher levels of immunoglobulin. This is an antibody which acts as an important first line of defence for the immune system. In his podcast, Mosley speaks to a doctor who has led several studies and says just single sessions of singing in a choir has been found to achieve reductions in chronic inflammation. She goes on to explain that this improves our immune system's capacity to respond to infections, adding, "This is really important because we know that inflammation is linked in with our mental health, for example, our depressive symptoms. Don't worry, be happy." In fact, singing has been found to positively affect mental health in many ways. On the podcast, they discuss a study involving women with postnatal depression. The women participating in singing programs reduced their symptoms by 40% in just a few weeks. We also learn that singing has been found to have a myriad of profound psychological and biological effects, so much so that it can help build our self-confidence, reduce loneliness, and impact levels of anxiety. Mosley's guest says, "These all occur alongside things like decreases in blood pressure, decreases in muscle tension, decreases in heart rate, and the activation of reward pathways in the brain." Other possible benefits of singing have been found to include improvements in lung function in people with lung disease and improvements in posture. I Will Survive. Perhaps it makes sense, then, that some GPs in England are beginning to refer patients to join a choir for a range of mental health issues, as well as chronic conditions as part of social prescribing schemes. On the podcast, the doctor says there are already clinical commissioning groups around England who've got choirs and other kinds of arts programmes set up in the community where they're directly referring people with chronic pain, and the results coming back are fantastic. Your song. So, how much time should you spend singing? Well, studies have shown that just a 5-minute burst is enough to bring positive effects. You might find that joining a live or virtual choir is a great way to cement this into your routine. Or you may feel that simply singing at home on your own with all windows closed is best for everyone. Whatever you decide, don't hold back. No matter how good or bad you are, singing is one of the few things in life which is truly rewarding, fun and free. As legendary jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald once famously said, the only thing better than singing, more singing. To learn more, just listen to Just One Thing with Michael Mosley, Sing. And that's www.bbc.co.uk/sounds/play/m0017bq. A Titanic Tale. Review volunteer Lynette Denzi tells the story of blind veteran Reg Bell and his marvellous model. The story of the sinking of RMS Titanic is well known, not least because of the popular 1997 film starring Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, which won 11 Oscars. Titanic was the largest ship afloat at the time she entered service. She sank in the North Atlantic on the 15th of April 1912 after striking an iceberg during her maiden voyage from Southampton to New York. The wreck was discovered in 1985, lying at a depth of 2.37 miles, that's 33.8 kilometres, and thousands of artefacts have since been recovered. The story of Reg Bell. Last year, our archivist Rob Baker was approached by the daughter of former blind veteran Reg Bell. While clearing out her parents' house following their deaths, Chris Bootle and her husband Paul came across this amazing 4-foot-long wooden model of RMS Titanic made by Reg and wondered whether we would like to keep it. Blind veteran Reg Bell was born in 1923 and joined the RAF in 1940. He suffered from age-related macular degeneration in later life and became a member in 2007. Through the charity, he learned to touch type and went on to type his own books about his travels, family life and wartime experiences. In his autobiography, My Life in a Nutshell, Reg said that he boarded SS Nea Helas in Glasgow on Friday the 13th February 1941. The Nea Helas, known fondly as the Nellie Wallace and less fondly as the Nea Hell, was on her way to Singapore with reinforcements for the garrison there. However, by the time they arrived, the city had already fallen to the Japanese and the ship was redirected to Egypt. The German advance was halted and the Battle of El Alamein saw the turning point in the war, but Reg remained in Egypt for 2 years until he answered an advert in Daily Orders. Volunteers wanted to return to England. Single men only. Married men will not be considered. Arriving back, he realized what he had volunteered for, frontline squadrons preparing for the invasion of Europe. Fortunately, the squadron was overstaffed, so Reg found himself back in Scotland working on flying boats and then high-speed motor launches. After the war in Europe came to an end, Reg was moved to 233 Squadron, which was when he met Lottie, the girl who would become his wife in 1947. They celebrated their 60th wedding anniversary in 2007. Now, the model of the Titanic. So, back to this wonderful model in wood of RMS Titanic. It was made by Reg around 2011 and took him 2 years to complete. It is extraordinary in its detail and beautifully made. Chris and Paul were happy to bring the model from their home in Buckinghamshire to Marylebone Station in London, and I was dispatched to collect the ship. It arrived in a smart, made-to-measure box constructed by Paul. It was clear how much the family appreciated the help received from the charity, enabling him to continue with his hobbies. They said that he and Lottie really enjoyed their visits to our Brighton Centre. Although Reg died in 2014, Lottie, along with Chris and Paul, were invited to join us at Buckingham Palace in 2015 for our centenary garden party, and their photo was one of those featured in Review's Centenary Edition. They had not seen the photograph, so were delighted to be given a copy of it. The model of RMS Titanic safely negotiated the tricky Marylebone Road in windy conditions and is now safely stored in our archives at Harcourt Street.
Carers Review. The latest information, opportunities and stories for the family, partners and carers of our members. Forget Me Not. Sharman Collins, a social worker at our Brighton Centre, gives an update on our current support for carers. At one of our recent family and carers engagement group meetings, I was struck by the mention of a phrase that sadly so aptly describes the role of unpaid carers, the forgotten army. How this group can be so forgotten, I simply don't understand. The latest figures show that 1 in 8 adults, 6.5 million people in the UK, are carers to their spouse, family member or friend. Meanwhile, 6,000 more people join these numbers every single day. Despite this, carers' allowance of £67.25 per week is the lowest benefit of its kind. And if you claim carers' allowance when you're over 65, it will be knocked off your pension. Unpaid carers save the UK £132 billion a year in public resources. If this isn't a good reason to look after them, I don't know what is. Fortunately, there are charities and organisations that fight for carers, such as Carers UK, who are currently lobbying for more support for this group when it comes to soaring energy prices. Let's hope the government listens. Here at Blind Veterans UK, we are also taking steps to support our members' carers, as we've learnt that coping with sight loss can be very hard for the whole family. So, what support do we offer currently? We run the aforementioned Family and Carers Engagement Group, a dedicated, supportive group which meets regularly and is open to all carers and family of our members. Any suggestions and feedback that come from this group are passed on to the National Engagement Group, so it really does have a voice within the charity. Our community support workers have received training to signpost carers for local authority support, and also hold local carers community groups and encourage local networking between carers. At the Brighton Centre, we offer breaks for carers, mainly virtual at the moment due to COVID restrictions. These provide much needed emotional support and a place for carers to share their ideas and coping strategies, as well as lots of laughter. We also offer member respite breaks at our Brighton Centre, giving carers a precious break and some time to recharge their batteries. And finally, we have a dedicated page on our website for all carers, full of information and guidance, as well as this regular feature in the review. If you're a carer or a family member of one of our members, do get in touch. We won't let you feel forgotten. What would you like to hear on this carers page? Contact Stacey Barham on 01273 391 483 or at Stacey, that's Stacey, dot Barham, Barham, at blindveterans.org.uk to share your ideas.
Centre News. An update on centre holiday bookings with details of who can apply and when and how much it costs. Llandudno Centre. Up until the end of September, the Llandudno Centre is offering holidays or respite stays for fully independent members and escorts who don't need care support only. We continue to monitor changes in guidelines with regards to bookings for residential and nursing members. Bookings for 1 or 2 weeks are available, and there is no limit on the number of bookings you make, although we do recommend a gap of 3 months in between stays. Members' individual circumstances will be taken into consideration with extra bookings may be made at the centre's discretion. Testing requirements. You are required to provide evidence of a negative lateral flow test, an LFT, on the day of arrival to the Llandudno Centre. Anyone who does not have symptoms can pick up a free lateral flow tests in most pharmacies or from a local collection point, or you can order online via 119. In case you're not able to pick up a test, our drivers will hold a stock. However, they are unable to administer the test and you will need to wait for 30 minutes for your results prior to boarding the vehicle. To make a booking, please call the Llandudno Centre on 01492 868 700, Monday to Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. And these are the centre accommodation charges for Llandudno. An independent stay in the main building. Weekly, 7 nights. Award-blinded members are £266, £38 daily. Non-award-blinded members, £343 for 7 nights or £49 daily, and those aged 3 to 16 years, £133 for 7 nights or £19 daily. And the Llandudno Leader Buildings self-catering and no transport, members for 7 nights, £273 or £39 daily, and those for aged 5 to 16, £112 for 7 nights or £16 daily. At the Brighton Centre. As we have permanent residents at Brighton, any bookings will be dependent on the latest guidelines for care homes. we are hopeful that the current easement of restrictions will mean we can offer a number of holidays and themed weeks over the summer period. We are in consultation with NHS England about this and hope to have a clearer picture after Easter. As always, we will keep you updated in the review. For all inquiries, please call the Brighton Booking Office for the most up-to-date information. And the Brighton Booking Office is open 8:30 in the morning to 4 p.m. in the afternoon, Monday to Friday, and their phone number is 01273 391 500, and the Brighton Centre Port Hall holiday only. Members for 7 nights is £231 or daily £33. Those aged 5 to 16, £133 for 7 nights or £19 daily. Centre Club weeks with no transport. War blinded members for 7 nights, £245 or £35 daily. Non-war blinded members for 7 nights, £322 or £46 daily.
National Creative Project Programme. This month's creative activities and hobby circles you can take part in, all from the comfort of your own home. The following activities are available to all members, whatever your experience or creative ability. Craft, a card for every occasion. For this project, you'll make 10 unique handmade greeting cards with a selection of materials and ideas we send you. Once finished, we hope you'll enjoy posting them out as an extra special way to say happy birthday, thank you, or simply hello to your friends or family. There will be an opportunity to join a group call by phone or video where you can chat to other members about the project and share ideas. Air drying clay. This project is an opportunity to experiment with air drying clay, no kiln required. We will send you everything you need to get started, including a set of tools for shaping clay, key guidance, and of course a pack of clay. The project comes with the option of joining a group call with up to 5 other members and 2 craft instructors to chat about how your creations are developing and to share any tips and advice you may have for working with air drying clay. Mantelpiece clock, wooden model project. We'll send you everything you need to complete this working wooden clock, including our VI-friendly instructions. These are very simple kits with pre-cut wooden pieces which are sanded, slot together and then glued. The assembled model is 6 inches by 9 inches by 4 inches, that's 15 centimetres by 22 by 10. The project comes with a group call opportunity where you can join up to 6 other members plus craft instructors for a chat. One member, Milton, recently sent us a photograph of his finished clock. He told us, "It took some doing. I'm 93 years young and registered blind, so I feel quite proud of my accomplishment. We love it." Art. Painting for beginners and improvers. March, April, May. If you're new to painting, this is a great way to ease into it with popular and interesting subjects presented on VI-friendly worksheets and audio description if required. If you've painted with us before, we hope to broaden your existing skill set and equip you with some great new materials to use. Themes for spring are trees in landscape, night scenes, dogs, collage, and one special bonus theme of celebration in honour of the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. You can attempt one after the other or combine them all, then send us your best works for a chance to feature in the review's gallery page or on the online gallery at the Blind Veterans UK website. There will be an opportunity to join a group call by phone or video to discuss your progress with your peers and our art and craft instructors. Gardening. We'll have a new gardening project for you to sign up to in our May issue. Jubilee bunting on a bag. Thank you to all of you who took part in this project. We're now assembling the artwork, ready to send you a beautiful Jubilee shopping bag, which will include your design in time for the celebrations in June. Your bunting designs will also be used to decorate the Brighton and Llandudno centres. For more information about the projects and groups or to request an activity pack, please call our bookings team on 01273 391 455, or you can visit our website at blindveterans.org.uk/NCP. Creative Book. The Creative Book project is now in the assembly stage. Thank you to everyone who took part. Once the book and online resources are completed, we will share them with you in Review magazine. Creative Hobby Circles. We would love to hear from you if you are interested in joining a monthly telephone or video call chat group. Chat groups have up to 6 fellow members with a shared interest, plus 2 of our staff. We're currently offering gardening, knitting, wood turning, mosaic, painting, woodwork and creative writing. We also have a Facebook page for photographers, Blind Veterans UK Photography, and a weekly photography chat group. Anyone with an interest in photography is welcome. You can find out more information about all our projects at blindveterans.org.uk/NCP. If you would like to give any of them a go, call us on 01273 391 455 or speak to your community support worker. Wishing you all a happy Easter, and that's from Lou Kirkpartridge and the National Creative Project team. Family news. Birthdays. Kenneth Brooks, who celebrates his 101st birthday on the 11th of April. Nora Day, who celebrates her 100th birthday on the 12th of April. Douglas Forrester, who celebrates his 102nd birthday on the 16th of April. Owen Hillier, who celebrates his 100th birthday on the 5th of April. Cynthia Holden, who celebrates her 100th birthday on the 22nd of April. Arthur Lawson, who celebrates his 100th birthday on the 19th of April. Pamela Mortimer, who celebrates her 102nd birthday on the 26th of April. Joyce Pullman, who celebrates her 102nd birthday on the 30th of April. Condolences. It is with deep regret that we record the deaths of the following, and we offer our heartfelt condolences. Deirdre Mary Croyman, who died on the 7th of January 2022, she was the wife of Robert Croyman. Jill Dunn, who died on the 1st of March 2022, she was the wife of Dennis Dunn. Leslie Faulkner, who died on the 2nd of March 2022, she was the wife of Morris Faulkner. Jennifer Mary Goodman, who died on the 9th of February 2022, she was the wife of Martin Goodman. Brenda Olive Hardy, who died on the 12th of February 2022, she was the wife of Albert Hardy. Cynthia O'Sullivan, who died on the 1st of February 2022, she was the wife of Michael O'Sullivan. Margaret Ivy Price, who died on the 1st of January 2022, she was the wife of Percy Price. Margaret Rose, who died on the 26th of February 2022, she was the wife of Trevor Rose. Margaret Ann Willoughby Stevens, who died on the 11th of February 2022, she was the wife of Julian Stevens. Dorothy Urquhart, who died on the 1st of February 2022, she was the wife of Don Urquhart. Fred Warhurst, who died on the 20th of February 2022, he was the husband of Ida Warhurst. And Christine Margaret Wilson, who died on the 14th of February 2022, she was the wife of Clarence Storlam. And all information was correct at the time of going to press. In memory, it is with deep regret that we record the deaths of the following members, and we offer our heartfelt condolences to their widows, widowers, families and friends. Matthew Avery of Washington, Tyne and Wear died on the 4th of March 2022, aged 99. He served as a sergeant in the Royal Engineers. James Brooks of Bolton died on the 3rd of March 2022, aged 94. He served as a private in the Royal Army Service Corps. Dennis Collins of Ely, Cambridgeshire, died on the 20th of February 2022, aged 95. He served in the Queen's Regiment. Brian Davies of Middlesbrough, Cleveland, died on the 1st of March 2022, aged 91. He served as an SAC in the Royal Air Force. Elizabeth Diacon of Warminster, Wiltshire, died on the 20th of February 2022, aged 99. She served as a section officer in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. Alice Jennifer Dove of Tunbridge Wells, Kent, died on the 14th of February 2022, aged 99. She served as an LACW in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. Kenneth Drury of Bristol died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 83. He served as a private in the Royal Navy. Harry Mitchell Furness of Clevedon, North Somerset, died on the 1st of March 2022, aged 96. He served as a private in the Yorkshire and Lancashire Regiment. Alan Thomas Frederick Goddard of Cinderford, Gloucestershire, died on the 15th of December 2021, aged 83. He served as a private in the Devonshire and Dorset Regiment. George Goucher of Lichfield, Staffordshire, died on the 17th of February 2022, aged 91. He served as an AC2 in the Royal Air Force. Jack Edric Hall of Huddersfield, Yorkshire, died on the 15th of February 2022, aged 92. He served as a sapper in the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. Barry Harper of Gloucestershire died on the 15th of February 2022, aged 87. He served as a trooper in the Royal Armoured Corps. Geoffrey Harradine of Bournemouth, Hampshire, died on the 7th of March 2022, aged 97. He served as a corporal in the 25th Dragoons. Frank Harrison of Sheffield, Yorkshire, died on the 14th of February 2022, aged 102. He served as a lieutenant in the Indian Army Service Corps. John Michael Heath of Middlesbrough, Cleveland, died on the 12th of February 2022, aged 93. He served as an AC2 in the Royal Air Force. Thomas George Harold Hillsley of the Isle of Man died on the 1st of December 2021, aged 99. He served as an LAC in the Royal Air Force. Douglas Jubilee Giles Hobbs of Rushton, Northamptonshire, died on the 9th of January 2022, aged 86. He served as a Lance Corporal in the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. Beryl Hudson of Newcastle, Staffordshire, died on the 1st of January 2022, aged 99. She served as a Lance Corporal in the Auxiliary Territorial Service. Rita Jeremiah of Leamington Spa, Warwickshire, died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 97. She served as an LACW in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. Dennis Kay of Pontefract, Yorkshire, died on the 20th of February 2022, aged 87. He served as an SAC in the Royal Air Force. William Wood Kenyon of Huddersfield, West Yorkshire, died on the 31st of December 2021, aged 99. He served as sergeant in the Royal Air Force. John Frederick Jason Lyle of Oswestry, Shropshire, died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 92. He served as an AC-1 in the Royal Air Force. Alan Lithgow of Bishop Auckland, County Durham, died on the 28th of February 2022, aged 82. He served as a Lance Corporal in the Army Catering Corps. Robert Kenneth McKernan of Liverpool died on the 24th of February 2022, aged 97. He served as a Fusilier in the Royal Scots Fusiliers. Arthur Miles of Coventry died on the 28th of February 2022, aged 93. He served as an AC-2 in the Royal Air Force. Dennis Murphy of Sunderland died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 71. He served as a sergeant in the Royal Logistics Corps. Albert Roy Newell of Reading, Berkshire, died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 89. He served as an SAC in the Royal Air Force. Peter Nyland of Liss, Hampshire, died on the 2nd of March 2022, aged 79. He served as a petty officer mechanic in the Royal Navy. William Henry Nutman of Dorchester, Dorset, died on the 13th of February 2022, aged 100. He served as an AC-1 in the Royal Air Force. Peter Francis Pascoe of Grays, Essex, died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 96. He served as a private in the Royal Army Service Corps. Michael Patterson of Chester-le-Street, County Durham, died on the 24th of February 2022, aged 86. He served as the Chief Petty Officer in the Royal Navy. Peter Edward Pavey of Hassocks, West Sussex, died on the 11th of February 2022, aged 96. He served as a private in the Royal Signals. Martin Harley Pribble of Rawton, Swindon, died on the 6th of February 2022, aged 85. He served as a corporal in the Royal Air Force. David Brian Price of Pontypool, Gwent, died on the 4th of February 2022, aged 88. He served as a corporal in the Monmouthshire Regiment. Violet Rees of Hinckley, Leicestershire, died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 102. She served as a sergeant in the Auxiliary Territorial Service. Grace Mabel Siddy of Woodbridge, Suffolk, died on the 15th of February 2022, aged 97. She served as an ACW-2 in the Women's Royal Air Force. Ronald Patrick Skidmore of Doncaster, Yorkshire, died on the 12th of February 2022, aged 89. He served as a corporal in the Royal Engineers. Charles John Smith of Hoddesdon, Hertfordshire, died on the 16th of February 2022, aged 101. He served as a driver in the Royal Air Force. Vincent Standish of St Helens, Merseyside, died on the 1st of February 2022, aged 98. He served as a stoker first class in the Royal Navy. Dorothy Thompson of Thornton Cleveleys, Lancashire, died on the 10th of February 2022, aged 95. She served as a private in the Auxiliary Territorial Service. Leslie Michael Uzzle of Kenilworth, Warwickshire, died on the 8th of March 2022, aged 87. He served as an LAC in the Royal Air Force. Roy Valentine of Lytham St Anne's, Lancashire, died on the 5th of March 2022, aged 88. He served as a corporal in the Royal Engineers. Derek Neil Vickery of Malden, Essex, died on the 5th of March 2022, aged 85. He served as a trooper in the Cheshire Regiment. Ida Warhurst of Manchester died on the 29th of November 2021. She served as a sergeant in the Women's Royal Army Corps. Frank Edwin Dennis Walden of Clacton-on-Sea, Essex, died on the 22nd of February 2022, aged 95. He served as an able seaman in the Royal Navy. Barbara Mary Whitehouse of Plymouth, Devon, died on the 9th of February 2022, aged 91. She served as an acting corporal in the Women's Royal Air Force. And Ian Keith Yule of Chichester, West Sussex, died on the 1st of March 2022, aged 87. He served as a private in the Royal Artillery. Memories of a Globetrotter. Member John Chapman, 90, shares snippets from his past travels around the world. Growing up in Japan. My father travelled around a lot for his job as a banker, so I was born in Yokohama, Japan, in 1931 and lived there for the first 9 years of my life. We had servants and amas, live-in housemaids, who were all very kind and helpful, particularly our chauffeur, Io San. I remember my father was very proud of his new car, a classic Lee Francis 1929, which he had shipped over from Liverpool. Fortunately, he got us out of the country well before the war started. Leaving was sad, but had to be done. We were lucky because my father knew what was going on before anyone else there, and even had all our furniture, carpets and ornaments shipped out, although he did have to leave his favourite car behind. School days in Canada. In late 1940, we arrived at Nanaimo, Vancouver Island, Canada, where my cousins lived. My father stayed in Tokyo until almost the last ship out and was so lucky to leave just in time before war broke out. I went to a school on the island for a year before we left for Montreal. I remember the trip by train took 4 days and was super as we travelled through Banff, Winnipeg and Toronto. I thought we were going to stay in Montreal as my father got a job there and we had a nice large apartment. I remember my school had canvas chutes to climb down in the event of a fire drill. What fun that was. However, he was soon transferred to New York and also given an apartment in Boston. As I needed to continue my schooling in Canada, I went to a boarding school close to Niagara Falls, ideal as I could travel by train overnight to see my parents in New York. After the war in England. When the war was over, I came to England with my sister, who had worked at the British Embassy in New York. We were able to go on the Queen Elizabeth, which was still used as a troop ship, and I remember seeing all the carved initials by the soldiers on the ship's rails. So sad to think that many must have died on D-Day and afterwards. Fixing fuses in Spain. I left my British school at 19 and in the following year decided to work on my Spanish by staying with a family in Madrid. On my arrival, the light fuses collapsed in their home and I surprised my host by offering to fix them. I always used to travel with my trusty screwdriver. Before long, I was offered a job teaching English to students, which was great fun. I made lots of friends, particularly as the students were practically the same age as me. National service in Kenya. When I was 22, I joined the Irish Guards Brigade Squad and, after a year, transferred to the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers and was sent to Kenya. This was during what was known as the Mau Mau Uprising, an armed rebellion launched by the Kikuyu. Our regiment, along with others, was to secure the safety of the British settlers. We were stationed along the slopes of Mount Kenya, and one of my duties was to help to supply platoons with their provisions. The Kenya Air Police Service provided a small Piper aircraft, and when the pilot told me to drop, I dropped the provisions. I remember feeling the air sickness. My platoon travelled everywhere by truck and quite often met thick clouds of locusts, which could be quite frightening. One of our successes was to find a Mau Mau clearing in the forest and deal with them. I wasn't happy about this, but unfortunately, this is what we were there to do. At one point, I had a 10-day break and went to Mombasa with a friend to stay at a well-known hotel. We hired a car and drove to Malindi on the coast to do some surfing. One interesting memory was travelling on a small ferry over two rivers, hauled across by local tribes chanting. My story in Kenya came to an end when I was demobbed. I came back by aircraft and remember seeing a perfect morning, sun-filled sky over northern Ethiopia from the plane. Disaster at Le Mans. I was grateful to find a job with an American finance company in Paris, and a few weekends later decided to go with friends to see the famous Le Mans 24-hour sports car race. Well, what a mistake that was. I was nearly killed by a somersaulting Mercedes which exploded right in front of me. The Daily Mail newspaper blamed the crash on the British Jaguar driver Mike Hawthorne, who they say drove recklessly to beat the Mercedes. Sadly, 84 people were killed and countless injured, including me. I lost my spleen and suffered a fractured pelvis. A story in the USA Boston Globe newspaper claimed that my wife travelled over to be by my hospital bedside, whereas in fact it was my mother. Later, my mother told me about the sad pile of lost shoes at the hospital following the accident. She said she managed to find my lost shoe as it was the only really shiny one. That's thanks to my time with the Irish Guards. Driving across Australia. As time went on, there was less need for US personnel at the company I worked for in Paris. So, thanks to a £10 offer to emigrate, I left in 1959 for Melbourne. I was 28. The tyre company, BF Goodrich, had started manufacturing the new tubeless tyres there, and I applied for a job. I was given the task of inspecting the tyres, which soon got a bit boring. So I resigned and offered to test some tyres by driving across to Perth. In those days, the road across Australia, called the New Ballabor Plain, was just a wide dirt road full of holes. I had a companion with me, which was a relief, because we sometimes got a bit stuck in drifts. One essential item I forgot to bring was a shovel, but we just about managed by using our metal food plates instead. We met a few passing cars along the way and always enjoyed the stops and cups of tea. We also helped carry mail to nearby outlying farms and received a few home-cooked meals as thanks. The whole trip took 19 days, but we were not in a hurry, and at least the tyres survived. Family life in Hertfordshire. I came back to England when I was 30 and met my wife, Rachel, through a friend. We were married in London in 1971 and moved to Hertfordshire, where we had our two sons, Stephen and Christopher. We now have four grandchildren. I began to lose my sight when I was in my 80s and was fortunate enough to hear about Blind Veterans UK through my local council. I've received lots of support from the charity and still dial in for the talks for members. My community support worker is very helpful, and I'm very grateful for all the staff do for me. So now it is quiz time, and our quiz master, Ron Russell, who celebrates his 81st birthday this month, tests your knowledge of everything Easter. I'll read out each of the 10 questions, and after reading each question, I will then give you the answer. So, question number one. What was the name of the Roman governor who presided over the trial of Jesus and gave the order of his crucifixion? And the answer, Pontius Pilate. Number two. The Easter bunny was originally a hare. True or false? And the answer, true. Number three. According to the Bible, what is the name of the garden in which Jesus was arrested? And the answer? Gethsemane. Number 4. And what did Jesus famously pray for those who crucified him? The answer? Forgiveness. According to the Gospel of St. Luke, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." The next question. Which chocolate company produced the first ever chocolate egg in the UK? And the answer is Fry's. Next question. True or false? Easter is named after the pagan goddess Oyster. And the answer? True. Question 7. According to the Bible, what was the name of the man forced to carry Jesus' cross? And the answer? Simon of Cyrene. Question 8. And on the day Jesus rose from the dead, who was the first person to discover the empty tomb? And the answer? Mary Magdalene. Question 9. What meat is traditionally eaten on Easter Sunday? And the answer? Roast lamb. And the final question, question 10. When it comes to eating chocolate bunnies, what do 76% of people eat first? And the answer? The ears.